Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. My guest today is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul was Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. He's been a Wall Street Journal Associate Editor. He's the holder of numerous academic appointments, including at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was a fierce critic of the Bush administration's policies, and he very much is that way about the Obama administration. Paul contributes to many popular websites, including Global Research. He's also the author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions, How Prosecutors and Bureaucrats Are Trampling the Constitution in the Name of Justice. Well, my goodness, they're certainly trampling the economy. Paul's newest article on Global Research, posted this week, he titles it, Can the Economy Recover? In his opening line, I think that pretty well sets the tone. He says, there is no economy left to recover. Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you. Your article really very, very well summarizes the mess that we're in. Explain that to listeners, and we'll have a break a few minutes after the hour and a few more when you hear music is coming on, and I'll interrupt, but why don't you begin and explain the mess that we're in?
Well, I'll try to do that. The mess that we're in is different from any mess we've been in before. It's not similar to a normal post-war recession, nor is it similar to the Great Depression, though the consequences could be as severe. What has happened to the United States with the advent of offshoring, a term that means that American corporations move the production of goods and services that they sell in American markets offshore and use foreign labor to produce the goods and services that they sell to Americans. And what this has done is to separate the American workforce from the incomes associated with the production of the goods and services that they consume. And so the income and employment levels in the United States fallen. There's been no real growth and American incomes, except for the super rich in the financial sector, in years. So how was the American economy kept going? It was kept going through debt expansion. Americans continued to spend more by borrowing. For example, the real estate bubble that Alan Greenspan got going, sent up house prices, so people refinanced their homes and spent the equity. That was one way to keep consumer spending going so that it would drive the economy. Another way is Americans maxed out credit card after credit card. And we finally reached the point where debt could, personal debt of individuals simply could not expand any further because they didn't have the incomes to support the debt service. And then, of course, we had the crisis with the falling real estate values, with the wipeout of people's savings and pensions. And this has stopped the possibility of the American economy based on credit.
Well, let me interrupt. That music means a break is coming up. Let's go ahead and take that, and then we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
The News Hour on with Paul Craig Roberts talking about the economic crisis. Paul, the offshoring, what a major problem. We've destroyed our manufacturing base, and it really began back in the 1960s. but I guess over the last 30 years, it picked up so much steam. So we became a service economy, and we financialized the economy, and Wall Street became a casino. And Alan Greenspan, during his tenure, and Bernanke, they blew successive. But, well, Greenspan, I guess, could take credit for two bubbles, the dot-com and then the housing bubble. And Bernanke hasn't missed a beat. And let me let you continue with all the things that you ticked off in your article. It really is a must-read article, again called Can the Economy Survive? Can the Economy Recover? And it was posted this week on Global Research, a lot of other websites too. And I strongly recommend that listeners read it. They can really get a very quick idea of all of the problems that were created and what we're going through. But please continue, Paul.
All right. Well, we got through the first step. The first step, of course, is the massive offshoring, not just of manufacturing, but of intellectual services such as software design, a lot of research and design work, accounting work, radiology, stock analysis, all sorts of intellectual skills that can be performed elsewhere and sent in on the high-speed Internet. So, and all of this started big time after the collapse of world socialism around 1990. Prior to that, there weren't massive sources of underutilized foreign labor, such as China and India. Prior to 1990, those countries would have been hostile to American corporations coming in, employing their workforce. So this is a relatively new phenomenon on the scale that has done the damage. Now, the second element of it is the dollar as a reserve currency, because what the offshoring does, it automatically increases dollar for dollar the trade deficit. Every time goods are moved from Ohio or Illinois or Michigan to Mexico or Canada or China or India to be produced, when they come back in, they count as imports. And so all of this enormous offshoring has led to a very large increase in the trade deficit. In fact, probably about half of the trade deficit is offshored goods and services. So what this means is there's a huge supply of dollars in foreign hands. They've used those. They've recycled them to buy U.S. Treasury debt. And now the holdings of dollar-denominated financial assets by foreign central banks, foreign governments, are immense. And they're so large that they are undermining the exchange value of the dollar. And the new budget deficits that we're experiencing this year and next year and most likely in subsequent years are so large as to raise the question of the dollar surviving as reserve currency. And so the foreign holders of vast amounts of dollars are starting to see if there's some other alternative, if they can get out of these dollars. And we have seen over time, and especially in the last few months, a continuing sink in the dollar's exchange value. So at some point, if the dollar becomes untenable as reserve currency, the United States would not be able to pay for its imports. We don't export near enough to pay our import bill, and the only way we can pay it is that the world accepts paper dollars for real goods and services because the dollar is the reserve currency. That's the only reason they accept it. And if it loses that role, then we have no way to pay for our imports. And it's not just energy. We're just as dependent on imported manufactured goods, on advanced technology products, and increasingly on services such as engineering. So this is a serious problem waiting to happen.
What chance do you see that will happen, if not imminently, a year, 2 years, 5 years?
Yes, I think that it's probably going to happen within 2 years. But I often see things unfolding, and I think they're going to happen quicker than they do. But it's going to happen unless the United States finds some way to reverse the budget and trade deficits. And they don't seem to be prepared to face either issue. So I think the problem will continue to develop. This brings us to the third part of the problem, which is how they're going to finance the current budget deficits. The deficit this year is four times larger than last year. The United States has never had to finance such a massive amount in one year. And the question is, what are the sources of the funds? It's clearly not the Americans. We're suffering from wealth loss, high unemployment. Foreign trade surpluses do not come close to the $2 trillion deficit we have. So even if they recycled all of it, it would still leave, you know, like $1.5 trillion that would have to be financed from somewhere. And there are only two sources. One is another collapse in the stock market, which would send people fleeing from equities into treasuries. And the other is to print the money. And so if they print the money this year to finance the deficit, the money supply will have doubled in one year. If they repeat that next year and print the money to finance next year's deficit, the money supply will have tripled in 2 years. And what this means is high inflation, despite the lack of consumer demand. You can't dump all that money into the economy, particularly when the supply of goods is shrinking because of unemployment and declining output, without having inflation. So we can have, for the first time, high inflation and high unemployment, which was quite different from the Great Depression, when falling prices went along with the unemployment. If you're faced with 20% unemployment and rising prices, you can see how much more severe that is on the population. So those are the kinds of problems that we face. Those are the causes, and those are the likely consequence, and they're not being addressed. They're not being addressed by the economics profession, which is stuck in some ancient change in way of thinking that all we need is a bigger stimulus. Well, the stimulus means more government debt, and that debt has to be financed. And as I have said, there's no way to finance it other than further equity collapse or printing money, and neither of those helps the economy. And the consumers are so in debt themselves, the notion that the banks would lend more is stupid. How can they lend to people who can't meet the loan standards because they're already over indebted? Somebody who can't make his mortgage payment is not likely to be able to borrow more money to spend on consumption. So the whole thing is in a glorious mess. The economics profession, from Paul Krugman on, are hopeless. They're out to lunch. The government is full of hubris. It imagines it's some sort of a superpower strutting around the world, starting wars wherever it wants, giving orders to the Russians and the Chinese. And they're just insane. They're simply crazy. The people in Washington running the country, the people on Wall Street, are just essentially insane.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I guess right now we're in a deflationary situation because, as you say, there's no question consumers are maxed out. They need to retrench. They need to pay off credit card balances. They're losing their homes. They're certainly not going out and buying new ones, these people. I think the homes that are being sold, Paul, there's a lot of distress sales that are being made. But it's a false picture, I think, of what really is going on. How can there be demand for homes when people really have no wherewithal to buy them, and they have no wherewithal to jack prices up substantially on consumer goods? So I guess for the time being, that's held in check. But as you say, if you print money with abandon, My God, I think I used a line once in an article that if you have X amount of dollars and you suddenly make it 2X, well, those dollars are now worth 50 cents. Maybe not tomorrow morning, but at some point those dollars are worth 50 cents. And what you're saying is that's where we're heading?
Yes, or worse. And you see, all this talk about a deflationary situation, this can be very misleading. That's not what the gold market thinks. Gold's at $1,000 an ounce because it's looking ahead. The deflationary situation, I mean, the deflation, people are thinking about the Great Depression, but what happened then was the Federal Reserve allowed the money supply to shrink by one-third. It's clearly not shrinking today. So
no
people
question
are
about
confusing
that.
The drop in the value of inflated assets with deflation. It's nothing like the Great Depression, though the unemployment rates are starting to look that way. For example, there are three ways of measuring unemployment. There's the U3 measure, which is what we hear reported all the time, which tells us that the national average now is 9.5%. Then there's another government measure, U6, which is a broader measure as it includes marginally attached workers, and it's 16.5.
Oh, indeed. So we have to take another break, Paul. And economist John Williams in his re-engineering ethan on a plane.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Paul Craig Roberts and the economy. All way back when, 1950s or 60s, forget the exact timeline, Charlie Wilson at General Motors made a famous statement, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. Well, maybe to some degree back then, and I guess the opposite statement today would be, what's good for Wall Street is wrecking the country. And then your article, I've seen the numbers too. It's shocking. You've got numbers for Goldman Sachs. They just boosted compensation and benefits by one-third. And annually, the average compensation per Goldman employee is $773,000. Now, that should be enough to get anybody pretty upset.
Well, yes, especially as they owe a lot of it to the public bailout money, which was free capital, which they used to take advantage of the situation and leverage up again and make more billions of dollars. So ability of Goldman Sachs to control the economic policy of the United States, they've been doing this since the Clinton administration. They've had, two or three Treasury secretaries, all sorts of officials, Fed officials. They're all who are all connected with Goldman Sachs and highly rewarded by them. Let me get back to this unemployment. There are three measures, as I said, two official government measures. The U3 is the one that we always hear, and this is a doctored measure that understates the unemployment. The U6. Another official government measure includes marginally attached people and the short-term discouraged. If you look at these numbers, at least 15 American states have double-digit unemployment as measured by the U3 number, the one that understates it. If you look at the second government measure, the U6, every state has double-digit unemployment. And if you look at a third measure, which no longer comes from the government, but various statisticians keep up, using the 1980 unemployment methodology, we have states now with extremely high rates of unemployment. This is the way it would have been measured, for example, in 1980. Michigan has a 33% unemployment rate. Oregon has a 27.5% unemployment rate. Nevada, 26. California, 26. South Carolina, 25, and so on. So these are extremely high rates of unemployment. What happened over time was the government ceased to count people who were unable to find jobs and became discouraged and dropped out of the workforce. They're simply not counted as unemployment. To be unemployed, you have to be actively searching for a job. So in the way they know that, I think, is in part from the unemployment benefits. So if you're not drawing unemployment and you're not actively in the market looking for a job, they don't count you as unemployed. So that was a Clinton era, a Clinton period change that disguises the extent of unemployment. So it's already severe. And so the notion that unemployed people, people with heavy debts and no assets, can be brought back into the economy by credit stimulus plans is absurd. Unless the credit stimulus plan is going to forgive everyone's debts and start over, there's no way that expansion of bank lending can revive consumer spending. There's just no way because they're too much in debt and they're too unemployed. So that is the picture and the situation.
And well, it's a very dire picture. I'm no economist, but it strikes me that aside from the enormous debt problem that we have to get out from under, the key to reviving this economy is getting people back to work. We're leeching jobs every single month, huge numbers of job losses, and this probably will go on for a good many months ahead. Could go on well into next year. Who knows? But we, unless we start creating jobs, and Obama has done nothing to create jobs, dribs and drabs here and there, unless we do that, it strikes me that the economy will just get worse. Is that your sense?
Yes, but exactly. But, you know, it's hard to create jobs when you've moved so much of the industrial and service base offshore. And when you do that, as I said initially, you have separated Americans from the incomes associated with the production of the goods and services that they consume. So if you don't get the incomes from the goods that you're making or buying, then you simply have no source of income. And that's what's happened. That's why the unemployment is high. That's why there's been no growth in income for years. And the only way they can do anything about this would be to somehow bring the offshore production back to the United States.
But that's nothing that you can do in the short term. But, of course, another thing, and we can maybe pick up on this when we come back, we could also have a massive infrastructure development program.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour on with Paul Craig Roberts on the economy. Paul, certainly cannot build plants overnight. The need is great. There's no question about that. But that is a long-term project. But it's a lot faster to crank up an infrastructure development situation around the country. Again, we did that in the 1930s. It didn't exactly get us out of the Great Depression rapidly or easily. It took a world war to do that. But it certainly put an awful lot of people back to work. So in that respect, it was very positive. What do you think about that now?
Well, it didn't. It's not a solution because it doesn't produce goods that can be sold. It doesn't do anything about the import problem that's destroying the dollar as reserve currency. Moreover, when the infrastructure project is finished, it's finished. There's no more employment. They're not permanent jobs. They're temporary jobs that last as long as the construction period lasts. And it produces no marketable goods. So it's not anything like a solution. Now, perhaps it's better for people's attitudes to be given a check for working on an infrastructure project than to be given a welfare check for doing nothing. And, of course, you would gain the infrastructure. And we have a lot of infrastructure that does need renewing. But this is for construction firms. How many of those jobs will be taken by illegal Mexicans? No one knows. So it doesn't deal at all with the problem, and it does nothing to offset the declining confidence in the dollar as a reserve currency. So I don't think there's much. It's better than nothing, perhaps, but there's nothing much to look for from that, other than for construction interest, some civil engineers who would be picked up by these projects. But it's not going to do much for the kinds of unemployment rates that we are facing now.
My great fear, and I really do have a very great fear about this, is that it took World War II to get us out of the Great Depression, so we really were pretty well bogged down until 1942.
Well, look, we already in major wars that cost that much, and they're not having any impact. In fact, it wasn't World War II that had anything whatsoever to do with getting us out of the Depression. It was the fact that the Federal Reserve stopped shrinking the money supply. And they let the money supply grow. If you take one-third of the money out of circulation, you're going to have a hell of a depression. And that's what they did. And they were so stupid, they didn't know that they had done that. In fact, we didn't understand that until the early 1960s when Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz published their Monetary History of the United States. They went through all the Federal Reserve minutes. They went through the measures of the money supply. They found out that they had shrunk the money supply. And that's what caused the depression, and what got us out of it was they stopped shrinking the money supply. But our problem today is much more, has many more facets to it and has no simple solution. The Great Depression could have been stopped instantly if they had known what they had done and what the problem was.
Today,
we know what the problems are, and there are just no readily or easable or usable solutions. So it's for war. It's not. Look, we've got three wars going. We've got Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and it looks like we might be starting one with Iran. It costs $775,000 a year to field one soldier. So it's $750,000.
$750,000 to put
for every
one soldier,
US soldier in the field. So
that's even more shocking than Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, well, that's right, but that's the cost. And so I don't think and what war does is it simply takes scarce resources and wastes them. And particularly these wars we're fighting now, they have no real purpose except some sort of vain hubris of American hegemony. So it's and what they do, they swell the budget deficit, which has to be borrowed. People have to understand the United States can't even finance its own wars. We borrow the money abroad. It's the Chinese that are financing it, the Japanese, the Saudis, the people who buy the hundreds of billions of dollars of treasury bonds. that are financing the war. So, in fact, you know, if they decided they had had enough of the inconvenience that we caused the rest of the world and stopped financing our debt, we wouldn't be able to get the troops home.
Well, indeed, Michael Hudson has been on this program several times. He referred to in 1971, we went off the gold standard and we went on the treasury standard. So foreign central banks, we don't let investment from some countries come back in here except to buy our treasuries. Western Europe, maybe Japan a little bit, but a good many countries. We don't let the Chinese come in and do it. We don't let the Russians come in and do it. We don't even let the Gulf states do it. So they recycle their petrodollars into treasuries and buying a lot of weapons from us.
Well, that's not exactly true, Stephen, because it's true that they tend to recycle the dollars into financial assets because it's in the past. That was safe. And it's
so they can buy stocks. They can buy stocks as well as bonds.
It's easier to handle if you have your reserves and treasury bonds. The big market's liquid. If you start buying companies, then you've got to have due diligence. You have to know what you're doing. You have to know how to run these companies and who their markets are and all this. But the Chinese have bought a tremendous amount. I think the Chinese bought up all the iron ore fields in Minnesota. A lot of foreign companies have bought up our toll roads. You know, we now sell the toll roads. The states and local jurisdictions sell the toll roads to get the upfront money. They don't really sell them. They put them out on 99-year leases. So even the Dulles Access Road that goes from the Beltway around Washington out to Dulles Airport, this is now in foreign hands. This was leased out for 99 years. Roads in the Chicago area, in Indiana, and toll roads have now been leased out for 99 years to foreigners for upfront money. The states are so broke that they're having to give up steady flows of income for short-term upfront money. So, and all kinds of companies have been bought. You know, the Chinese bought the personal computers from IBM. They bought their computer arm. There's all sorts of foreign takeover of American companies. In fact, there's a site online. It's maintained by Macy Block. And the name of the site escapes me at the moment, but it lists the hundreds, if not thousands, of American companies that are now in foreign hands. And it's a massive amount of money. It's not just treasuries that they recycle their trade surpluses to buy. They've also gradually taken over very large chunks of what's left. And what this means is that the income flows from the toll roads, from dividends, from interest on bonds, these now are also directed away from Americans into foreign hands. And those outflows are like imports. They raise the current account deficit, which is the trade deficit plus the income flows. So wherever we look, we're just doing ourselves in, and the desperation is high and getting higher. And now the states, of course, are unable to print money or borrow endlessly like Washington. And you've got states like California, which are about to hit the wall because they have massive deficits. They have no way of financing. California is issuing IOUs, paying its bills with IOUs, tax refunds to California citizens on their income tax with IOUs. And the situation is really quite desperate.
California, Paul, is a metaphor for what's heading for a good many of the states, maybe most all of them before this is done. And of course, Washington is extending no aid. So
they're not Goldman Sachs.
They're not Goldman Sachs.
The states aren't banks. The insurance company, the automobile companies, they didn't get any help. Only Wall Street. Now that tells you the plan
that was tentatively, well, I guess it was agreed on in California. I guess there'll be a big ruckus about it. Who knows how it'll all wash out? Probably it'll pass, but it really just wrecks vital services in the state, from education to health services.
We don't know how important a lot of those services are. But what we do know is it's going to wreck the incomes of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, of more Californians.
Well, they're going to make college unaffordable for lots more kids. I don't know what they're going to do to the public schools. They're going to fire teachers.
That's what you say. What does that do then to the teachers?
Well, they're going to fire teachers.
That's right. So then what happens to their incomes?
And then maybe the most important thing.
What happens to all the incomes of the California state employees whose programs are shut down? So what this does, maybe it balances the budget, but it also destroys the incomes of huge numbers of Californians. So it adds to that problem. You see, maybe it will reduce the California budget deficit and therefore maybe contribute to that problem, but it's going to cause another problem, which is, gosh, now we got hundreds of thousands of people who had jobs, but now they don't. Kids that were out of the labor force because they were in school, but now they're not in school, and now they're in the labor force, and the unemployment rate's higher. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Instead of creating jobs, they're going to create more unemployment. How the devil you solve an economic problem by creating more unemployment?
Right. That's what all the state budget balancing does. It creates more unemployment, and therefore it doesn't get us anywhere, really. It gets the state out of the difficulty of not being able to balance its budget, maybe, but it certainly creates even worse problems. So,
and then, Paul, if they balance their budget now, but they create more unemployment, your economic situation gets worse, and they have another budget crisis they have to deal with.
Yeah, look at it this way, too. You see, look at all the state pension systems. See, they're going to all hit the wall.
Oh, indeed.
Recently, the guy in charge of Alabama's public pension systems said that by the end of this year, he thought Alabama might make it through the end of next year. The state pension systems aren't going to be able to pay the pensions of the retirees. And now look at what that means. All you're an old person, you're retired, you've got your secure state pension. All of a sudden you don't have it. It's gone. What do you do? So that problem is also waiting in the wings or coming. There doesn't seem to be anything to stop that from happening, because the revenues of the states are down. Even if they balance their budgets, the revenues are down. Everything's cut. The investments, to the extent that any of those state programs have an investment basis, they've been devastated by the misbehavior of the financial system in destroying people's equity shares and real estate values. And so you've got this prospect that all the tens of millions of retired public school teachers and state employees are simply going to be left without any income.
I like the phrase, we're in the process of turning America into Guatemala. And I think it's no exaggeration that it seems this is where we're heading, Paul. I just can't imagine in my lifetime ever running into a situation that would be this bad, and policy being so counterproductive that instead of working to solve a problem, we're just making a greater problem. And these aren't stupid people. You were a high-level Treasury official. You were around a lot of smart people. You know that There aren't a lot of, there may be a few dummies around, but there are a lot of smart people in Washington as well. And they sure as heck know the right thing to do.
I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
No, I think in Washington there are a lot of bought people. They're bought by the interest groups that rule the country. And there are usually very few officials in the government that's not bought. This is why even, and this includes the president, as well as all the senators and congressmen.
Well, I absolutely agree on that, but it doesn't mean they don't have brains. But
well,
indeed
I'm
they are
sure.
Bought.
I'm not sure. They may have some kind of cunning. But if you look at the utterly stupid things that they do and get caught with, it makes you wonder. Because, I mean, you know, you look at some of these sex scandals. It's just unbelievable. Anybody would be this careless. Look at the governor who disappears for a week and while he runs off to South America to be with his mistress. Now, why doesn't the governor think, I'm going to have to explain where I was for a week? Nobody could find me. They couldn't find the governor. Now, how often do you have a governor just disappear? And this guy thinks that he can disappear for a week and go to South America and enjoy his mistress, and somehow this isn't going to come out. No, I don't think they're smart. I think they're egomaniacal, and they're insecure, and they need a stage to strut around on to make them feel like they're somebody. And they don't exercise judgment or intelligence. When I was in the government, I saw very little intelligence.
Well, you've been where I have never been, Paul. We need to take another break, and we'll finish up. Maybe I'm giving these people brain credit more than they deserve. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Final segment with Paul Craig Roberts. Paul, in the midst of all of this, again, your article pretty well summarizes the situation they were in. And we look at what's happening. We see people really suffering terribly. The middle class is being destroyed. Only a very small slice at the top are doing very, very well. Certainly the big ones in the financial industry, most folks on Wall Street, the other major banks, and a few of them are really doing maybe better than they've ever done before. But I see some pretty dark clouds out there, and I really fear for what may be ahead. Any predictions on what things will look like a year, 2 or 3 years from now?
Yeah, worse. Most likely there'll be high inflation, high unemployment. The dollar will no longer be the reserve currency. It will have very little purchasing power. When people go to Walmart, instead of seeing cheap prices, low prices, they'll think they're in Neiman Marcus because of the dollar's loss of exchange value. And you see, it's not just that there are dark clouds. We're already in the storm. I want to come back to these unemployment rates. This is an official Bureau of Labor Standards unemployment rate, the U6. It differs from the one that's reported because it has short-term discouraged workers, whereas the reported unemployment that you get from the news is just simply the people on unemployment benefits. So if you take the U6 measure, an official measure, I'm not talking about measuring it the way it was measured in 1980, but it's still an official measure of short-term of unemployment includes short-term discouraged workers. Michigan has a 26.3% unemployment rate. Oregon, 22%. Nevada, 21%. California, 21%. South Carolina, 20.3%. Rhode Island, 20.2%. Florida, 19.2%. Ohio, 18.8%. Tennessee, 18.5%. North Carolina, 18.4%. Indiana, 18%. West Virginia, 17.9%. Illinois, 17.5%. Kentucky, 17.5%. Georgia, 17.3%. Washington, the state, 16.8. Alabama, 16.1. The District of Columbia, that is the seat of government, 16. Wisconsin, 15.8. New Jersey, 15.7. Maine, 15.5. Arizona, 15.3. And it goes on. All of them are double digit. This is the official rate. So, I mean, you see, they fool people by how they report the numbers.
Now, just imagine if there were daily reports on Bloomberg and CNBC with those numbers listed, instead of the stock market having a party.
Yeah, the programs would be closed down.
The programs would be closed down? The programs would go off the air.
The advertisers, the government, the advertisers, the government wouldn't renew the broadcast licenses. The advertisers would pull their advertising. You see, part what Washington thinks is one way to get out of this trouble is to fool people and make them think it's not really much trouble. This is why they keep talking about green shoots and recoveries on the way. And this causes idiots to put money in the stock market.
Oh, indeed.
The stock market goes back up, but there's no basis there.
I got to cut you off. We're out of time. The hour does fly. It was a great discussion. I hope as things get worse ahead, you'll come back and you'll update us again.
Let's hope I'm completely wrong.
we indeed hope that you're wrong. Many thanks, Paul. Join us again tomorrow, again on The Economy. Be with us.
Okay.
With recent internet.